Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Albrecht. First on this week's program, Gallego waffles on mass deportations won't knee-jerk reject Trump plans. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on January 3rd. Once upon a time, Ruben Gallego wasn't scared to clown Donald Trump for his terrible immigration policies. During Trump's first term in the White House, Gallego used his platform in the House of Representatives to forcefully call out the MAGA president over border security. In a 2017 op-ed in the Arizona Republic titled, "Why We Should Not Ever Build Trump's Border Wall, Ever," Gallego called the wall a monument to Trump that was trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. That same year, Gallego released a statement opposing the Trump administration's new guidelines for who can be deported, which Gallego said, lay the groundwork for mass deportations. Gallego wrote, "I am dedicated to holding the Trump administration accountable and will continue to call out these policies for what they are. Un-American." Mass deportation is explicitly what Trump has promised for his second term. But, good news. Once Gallego is sworn in Friday as a U.S. Senator, he'll be in an even more powerful position to push back forcefully against the Republican president's harmful immigration policies. Now, having won a statewide election while muzzling his inner firebrand and tacking to the middle on border security, he'll finally be able to let the anti-MAGA dogs loose. Right? Nope. At least not yet. On Thursday, Gallego met with members of the Arizona Press to discuss his goals as a senator. Howie Fisher of Capital News Service asked Gallego what he intends to do about the president-elect's plans for what Trump has called the largest deportation operation in American history. Instead of responding with the old progressive vim and vigor, though, Gallego met the question with a middle-of-the-road non-answer. Gallego talked about what he heard Arizonans on the campaign trail say they wanted. More border security, more U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers, border walls where necessary, and a certain type of illegal immigrants deported. What he didn't hear Arizonans support is family separations, and I didn't hear about no jailing of kids. Trump did exactly those things his last time in office, but Gallego professed ignorance of the incoming administration's specific deportation plans, and said he wouldn't knee-jerk reject anything that comes from the White House. Instead, Gallego said he hopes to work with the White House to solve border security issues for which his constituents vocalized their support. "We're going to wait and hear what their actual goals are," Gallego said. "See if we can work together to really fulfill what Arizonans asked me to do." One problem, though, the idea that the Trump administration's goals are ill-defined strains credulity. Trump's border czar is Tom Homan, the same guy who led ICE when the agency separated migrant children from their parents, a policy that Gallego and others heavily criticized. For Trump's second term, the president-elect has handed Homan the keys to the deportation machine, which Homan will use to similar ends. Homan hasn't been evasive about his aims. When NBC News asked the former Border Patrol agent how he would go about his mass deportations, and specifically how the administration would keep families together, Homan provided a less than reassuring answer. He doesn't want to be breaking up families, he said. Instead, the only way you don't break up the family is you keep them together, and you have to send them all back. That would include, of course, U.S.-born children who are American citizens. In other media appearances, Homan has suggested using the U.S. military, the private sector, and local authorities to aid the federal government in conducting mass deportations. He also said the federal government will set up a phone line that people can use to snitch on potential undocumented immigrants in their communities. With Gallego's newly announced appointment to the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, the freshman senator is in a unique position to stifle such a reign of anti-immigration terror. Instead, Gallego said Thursday that he wants to secure more funding for ICE that will allow the agency to work with law enforcement to deal with criminal aliens that do exist in this country, especially those who we believe should be deported. He'd also try to figure out if there is a pathway to immigration reform. And endorsement of mass deportations? Hardly. But neither was it a full-throated repudiation of it. Gallego failed to mention DACA recipients, the children of undocumented immigrants who have been protected from deportation because they were brought to the country at very young ages. Gallego has been a strong supporter of DACA protections in the past. Though many Trump allies would love to eliminate those protections, the threat to DACA didn't merit a mention from Gallego on Thursday. When asked directly about mass deportations, Gallego equivocated rather than denounced. Arizonans and pro-immigrant advocates who are girding themselves for a fight better hope the old Gallego is still in there somewhere. Or they may want to find themselves another champion. Here's a story written by T.J. Leheru and posted on January 3rd. GOP lawmakers' bill would ban unhoused people from traffic medians. For the third year in a row, a Republican state lawmaker is seeking to make it illegal for unhoused people to be in traffic medians. Last month, GOP State Senator John Kavanaugh of Scottsdale filed a bill for the upcoming session to criminalize pedestrians standing in medians. Senate Bill 1029 seeks to make it illegal for pedestrians to remain on a painted traffic median or a raised traffic island or median that is less than 10 feet wide, unless they are crossing from one side of the street to another or are dealing with an exigent circumstance, like a medical emergency. Kavanaugh told Phoenix New Times it's a question of safety for him. I do think it's necessary to clear people off of narrow medians because of the danger involved to them and cars that might hit them, Kavanaugh said. It's just dangerous when you're doing 30, 40, 50 miles an hour and there's somebody on a narrow median a foot away from you, especially some of them who might be intoxicated, which occasionally happens. Kavanaugh said he hoped safety will prevail over politics and result in the bill's approval. Currently, the text of the bill specifies no penalty for a violation, though Kavanaugh said he planned to amend the bill to state that a first violation results only in a warning. It's not clear what would happen after that. But Democrats and advocates for unhoused people say the bill, which will largely target unhoused people who panhandle at stoplights, does little to actually help the people it supposedly protects. When you don't offer services to help them, what you're doing is effectively creating laws to eliminate them, homelessness advocate Ben Jeffries said. He added that the bill would exacerbate the marginalization of those who are already vulnerable and struggling to survive. Jeffrey took issue with the bill's vagueness and said enforcing it would be difficult and inconsistent. The language surrounding exigent circumstances is troublingly vague and open to misuse, Jeffrey said. Are we genuinely expecting pedestrians to justify their emergency status while standing on a narrow median, dodging traffic? Democratic State Representative Annalise Ortiz, now a state senator-elect, also ripped the bill, calling it nothing more than a move to criminalize a symptom of poverty, rather than address the root causes of homelessness in Arizona. Republicans have no evidence this policy will increase public safety, Ortiz said. Meanwhile, they refuse to adequately invest in social services and homelessness preventative measures, making all of us less safe in the long run. There is no data that suggests people standing in medians are causing accidents or injuries. Kavanaugh said, the number of accidents related to people standing in medians is an unknowable statistic, because there is no code for such incidents on accident reports. Asked if he's heard anecdotal reports of accidents involving pedestrians in a median, Kavanaugh wasn't specific. Every now and then you hear about someone being hit, he said, but it's hard to tell if it's someone crossing the street swiftly or just standing there. Not the first try. This isn't the first time Kavanaugh has filed a bill to ban pedestrians from being in medians. He pushed a similar bill, Senate Bill 1022, during the 2023 session. It languished in the Senate's Rules Committee and never received a vote. That version's language was more focused on people asking for money, making it illegal to sell goods, solicit donations, or beg on a median. Kavanaugh said, about 90% of the time, people standing in medians are unhoused and asking for money. But he noted that sometimes people are selling things, like roses, on Valentine's Day. Last year, Republican State Representative Joseph Chaplick, Kavanaugh's district counterpart in the Arizona House, filed a bill that bears striking resemblance to Kavanaugh's current one. Chaplick's bill actually passed both the House, with the support of four Democrats, and the Senate, before being vetoed by Governor Katie Hobbs. In her veto letter, Hobbs cited the need to protect constitutional rights. Recognizing the importance of constitutionality-protected rights, it is critical that we approach these matters with precision to avoid infringing on Arizonans' freedoms, Hobbs wrote. A spokesperson for Hobbs did not respond to her request for comment. State Representative Patty Contreras, an Ahwatukee Democrat, opposed Chaplick's bill in committee and on the House floor last session. I felt it was unenforceable and would take police officers off of more important calls, Contreras said at the time. Critics of Kavanaugh's latest bill make similar arguments. Jeffrey called it a feeble attempt at blaming the most marginalized populations. This bill does not solve any problems, Jeffrey said. It simply takes blame from a structurally violent society that wants to eradicate homelessness at all costs, acting like it's a behavioral problem, when we know that it's an affordable housing problem. Phoenix police kill armed man in Whataburger shootout. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeroux and posted on January 2nd. Late morning, on December 18th, 62-year-old Marion Joyner walked into a West Phoenix Whataburger with an assault rifle and told everyone in the restaurant to leave. After an ensuing standoff, during which time Phoenix police officers in the parking lot traded fire with Joyner, an officer shot through one of the restaurant's windows, killing Joyner. Joyner was the 14th and final person shot and killed by Phoenix police in 2024. On Thursday, the Phoenix Police Department released a critical incident briefing on the shooting, which is made public after any police shooting or in-custody death. The briefings are narrated by officers and include dispatch audio, body-worn camera footage, and, in the case of Joyner's death, surveillance footage from inside the restaurant. The footage and audio from the December 18th shooting show Joyner entering the restaurant and customers and staff fleeing, as well as the standoff with cops that preceded Joyner's death. But they do little to fill in the blanks of why he entered the restaurant in the first place and why he fired upon officers. From standoff to shootout. At about 11 a.m. on December 18th, Joyner pulled up to and entered the Whataburger on Thunderbird Road and 28th Avenue, raising a rifle in the air. He came ripping into the parking lot, slammed on his brakes, and just walked in with it pointed up straight in the air, one 911 caller said in dispatch audio released by the police. The caller said that Joyner was holding an AR-style rifle, though police declined to confirm the make of Joyner's weapon, or how many rounds he had in his possession. The caller also said Joyner was not pointing the rifle at anyone, which is reflected in surveillance video included in the briefing. According to police, Joyner told one customer and four employees in the Whataburger to get out. Within a minute, all had exited the store, though the customer stopped at the doorway and returned to his table to apparently grab his phone. Nothing in the video released by police suggests Joyner tried to rob the restaurant. Surveillance video from outside the store shows that at one point before police vehicles arrived, Joyner exited the restaurant and pointed his rifle at a police helicopter in the air. Officers arrived on the ground shortly after and surrounded the building, beginning a standoff with Joyner that lasted roughly 20 minutes, police said. Police said Joyner then fired his rifle through the glass windows of the store, shooting at officers on three occasions. According to police, officers returned fire twice. Video surveillance from inside the Whataburger shows the interior of the restaurant as gunfire is exchanged between Joyner and officers outside. Joyner fires through windows on different sides of the restaurant before sitting on a bench. Police said one patrol car was hit by gunfire, but no officers were injured. Later, video footage shows a police drone entering the restaurant. Sitting casually, cross-legged in a seat, Joyner raised his rifle at the drone, at which point an officer shot him, according to police spokesperson Sergeant Brian Bauer. Though Joyner's body is largely blurred in the surveillance video released by police, which contains no sound, he appears to suddenly slump over after raising the weapon. In body camera footage from three officers outside the restaurant, one is heard firing his rifle before saying, "I think I got him." Police then enter the Whataburger and determine that no one else was in the store. Joyner was pronounced dead when five fire personnel arrived. Five officers, Rudy Castillo, Austin Diaz, Chase Dittweiler, Josue Murillo, and Justice Stokes, all fired at Joyner, police said. They all work in the Cactus Park Police Precinct and have a range of 2 to 24 years of experience with the department. When asked if the officers were still on active assignment, the department spokesperson referred Phoenix New Times to its policy, which states that officers involved in shootings automatically receive 3 weeks of non-patrol duty. Under investigation. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office opened a criminal investigation into the shooting, and police are conducting an internal investigation to determine if the officers follow department policy. The shooting capped off a year when the U.S. Department of Justice released a long-awaited report on Phoenix Police. Among other conclusions, it found that Phoenix Police have a pattern of using excessive and unjustified deadly force. The Phoenix City Council and many politicians, including Democratic Senator-elect Ruben Gallego, have opposed a consent decree, which would place the department under independent oversight. However, with Republican Donald Trump set to reassume the presidency in January, it appears unlikely that the DOJ will compel Phoenix Police into a binding agreement. Next, a story written by T.J. LeHeroux and posted on December 30th. Couple says Phoenix cops beat and tased them after they called 911. Just after midnight on December 11th, 2022, Julie and Everett Mills called Phoenix police to report that their son had damaged their car window with a rock. But when police officers arrived, the married couple claims in a lawsuit they barged into the Mills' West Phoenix home, where they beat, tased, and arrested the pair for aggravated assault on an officer. The couple, whom police records note are black, filed a lawsuit in Maricopa County Superior Court on December 5th against the city of Phoenix. It alleges that the actions of officers Jacob Viviano and Henry Nayrick, who are not named as defendants in the suit, amounted to a battery, false imprisonment, and invasion of privacy. The Phoenix Police Department used excessive force to violate Ms. Mills' constitutional rights, Benjamin Taylor, the attorney representing the couple, told Phoenix New Times. This lawsuit seeks justice for her in order to hold Phoenix police accountable for their actions. Phoenix police spokesperson Sergeant Phil Krinsky declined to answer questions from New Times about the incident, as well as a subsequent report from the Office of Transparency and Accountability that found Phoenix police did not adequately conduct an internal investigation. According to the police report from the incident, Viviano said he was told by the 911 dispatcher that there were sounds of a physical fight and a female was yelling to get police at the residence when the Mills had initially called police. In his report, Viviano noted that he and Narek arrived at the scene and saw the door and screen door of the house open and the couple arguing loudly. Viviano said when he got closer, he noticed Everett's hand was bleeding and that there were blood droplets on the floor and Julie's dress. In their lawsuit, the couple says Julie Mills walked out of her front door to greet the officers who both rushed inside the home and stood in front of the door. She requested that the officers go back to the driveway to investigate the damage to her vehicle, but the officers declined. Julie Mills then called 911 again to request a police supervisor be sent to the house. I tried to inform them that I had reasonable suspicion that a crime occurred, Viviano wrote in his report. But Viviano wrote that the confrontation became physical, as both Everett and Julie insisted they did not give the officers permission to enter their house. In his report, Viviano claimed Julie tried to shove him, after which he decided to detain both for not allowing the officers into their home. The lawsuit, on the other hand, claims that Viviano threw Julie Mills down onto the floor without justification. Then, after a third officer arrived, the cops began physically beating Everett and slammed him onto the floor. The lawsuit says that when Julie tried to get up, Viviano tased her. The officer then tased Everett as he was lying face down on the floor and restrained in handcuffs, before turning back to Julie to tase her again. The couple claims they both suffered painful injuries as a result. Incomplete internal investigation. New Times requested the body camera footage from the Phoenix Police Department, but that request has not yet been fulfilled. However, the incident was investigated by the city's Office of Accountability and Transparency, which criticized the police department's own internal investigation. However, because the OAT has been stripped of any real power over the police, it's not clear if any of its recommended reforms have been enacted. The oversight agency found that the police department's internal investigation into the incident, which determined there was no misconduct, was woefully inadequate. OAT's conclusion following review is that the investigation was not thorough and complete, the report noted. These allegations also have the potential for city liability as possible constitutional and federal law violations. The report stated that the case should have been referred to the department's Professional Standards Bureau for a full and formal investigation. In a response that the department is required by OAT law to provide, the department agreed with that conclusion. Had the complaint been handled by PSV, the individual allegations and the circumstances leading to the investigative conclusions could have been better documented, the department said, noting it would update its manual to ensure its officers investigate all allegations. It's not clear if Phoenix implemented those changes, which the department said it aimed to complete by November 28. The department noted that while the Bureau did receive the complaint, it only investigated portions of it, before finding that the officer's violent force was within policy, but that one officer could benefit from additional training / career development. It's also unclear which officer that was, or whether they received additional training, nor is it clear whether the officers involved received any discipline. OAT lacks the enforcement teeth to mandate changes or discipline, meaning any reforms undertaken or discipline leveled by police is entirely voluntary. OAT was created in 2021 to be a robust, independent civilian oversight organization, but its powers have since been watered down. Earlier this year, its director resigned after what he said was too much meddling from city officials. Additionally, a state law signed by former Governor Doug Ducey took away OAT's power to investigate police misconduct. Now, OAT can only investigate the internal investigations that police departments conduct, and can only recommend changes. The Mills' lawsuit comes about 6 months after the U.S. Department of Justice finished its years-long investigation into Phoenix police, noting in its final report that the notoriously violent police department regularly committed a litany of civil rights violations. Those patterns included discriminating against people of color, using excessive and unnecessarily deadly force, and arresting unhoused people without cause. Phoenix Police Chief Michael Sullivan was brought in to lead the department in December 2022 as it dealt with the probe. Sullivan will remain at the helm of the department until August 2025. Why can't enough Arizona students read? Untangling a literacy crisis. This next story was written by Sahara Sajadi and was posted on December 30th. Samantha Hunahan is a biology teacher at Cactus High School in Peoria. With her freshman students, she routinely runs into an instructional problem that has nothing to do with cells, mitosis, or photosynthesis. Too few of them read well enough to learn the material, with some struggling to read basic case studies. The teenagers are supposed to be preparing for adulthood, and yet too many are already behind. It's bad as they walk in the door, Hunahan said. For them to not know basic vocabulary words, as I'm trying to teach them new scientific vocabulary, it becomes a whole vocab lesson. Hunahan's experience is hardly an anomaly in Arizona. The state students need help reading, and they're not getting it from policymakers. Currently, just 41% of Arizona's third-grade public school and charter students are reading at their grade level, compared with 67% nationally. That means more than half are lagging at reaching a crucial milestone, as third grade is when many students no longer learn to read, but instead read to learn. A student's literacy rate at this age can predict their future success in their academic and professional life. Students with lower literacy levels have fewer chances of long-term success and are more likely to drop out of high school. When they reach advanced classes, such as the one taught by Hunahan, whose job is not to help them with nouns and adverbs, the teachers of those courses are left to pick up the pieces as best they can. Curtailing this phenomenon is critical to ensuring academic success and a successful adult life, but like so many of the state students, Arizona has a lot of catching up to do. Since 2013, Arizona officials have attempted to improve literacy levels with the Read On Arizona Initiative, a statewide objective to boost literacy rates to 72% by 2030. Instead, third grade proficiency hasn't improved at all since 2016. So why can't enough Arizona students read? The reasons are multifaceted, but most of them come down to one thing, a lack of resources. Teachers blame bloated class sizes and a chronic absenteeism problem that Arizona has struggled to correct since the COVID-19 pandemic. They especially blame school vouchers, which have sapped funds from the public school system. When you habitually divest from a system and continue to take money away, especially in lower socioeconomic areas, we see these low literacy rates, said Raquel Mamani, an elementary school teacher and a board member of the advocacy group Save Our Schools Arizona. If there's no money for literacy, there's no money for the school. She added, Arizona's in a really, really devastating point. Overcrowded classrooms. Terry Clark doesn't deny the numbers. Arizona's literacy rate is far below where it should be. Clark is the state's literacy director, and she agrees that a lack of resources is a problem. "We've got research that continues to tell us how to teach reading well and how kids learn to read," she said. "We just need to support schools and be able to deliver that high-quality literacy instruction that every child should have access to." Arizona's teachers would love that support. Many say they're not getting it. Kathleen Heyman lays some of the blame at the foot of class sizes. As a fifth-grade teacher in Peoria Public Schools for nearly 26 years, she was constantly challenged by overcrowded classrooms. At one point, she said, she had more than 30 students in a class. "It's very difficult. It slows things down for the whole class," Heyman said. "There's just not enough time in the day to deal with students with behavior problems. These things really affect literacy for the whole group." Heyman is now retired from teaching, but her daughter has continued in her footsteps, building a teaching career of her own. Heyman says the class problem is only getting worse. In the 2020-21 school year, the most recent year for which data is available, Arizona's average class size was 22.6 students, slightly higher than the national average of 20.7. That school year encompassed much of the pandemic, so the average class size is likely larger now. "The students need more time, smaller class sizes," Heyman said. "I can't tell you the fabulous effect that that would have." One thing is keeping class sizes down, but it's not helping literacy, thanks to Arizona's school choice regime, which has allowed charter schools to proliferate and has allowed taxpayer money to be spent on private school education. Some public school districts are facing enrollment issues. With lower enrollment comes fewer funds. Heyman attributes part of the blame to Arizona's voucher program, formerly known as Empowerment Scholarship Accounts. "The money is going somewhere else," she said. The role of ESAs. The rise of ESAs led to a $332 million deficit in the Arizona state budget for fiscal year 2024. That number is projected to grow in the coming years, according to a study by the Grand Canyon Institute. It's costing Arizona public schools. Arizona ranks last in the nation for public education, per a study by Consumer Affairs. ProPublica found that these vouchers are hardly used by lower-income families. Instead, affluent families are taking advantage of them, depriving public schools of funding while benefiting private schools. The program also has been rife with fraud. Earlier this month, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays announced charges against a couple who allegedly bilked the state of $110,000 in ESA funds for fake children. "It's off the rails, it's out of control, and it's costing Arizona," Momeny said. "It's budget busting, and without any oversight, it's just ripe for fraud." Even when used legally, ESAs hurt public schools. Recently, the Roosevelt School District Governing Board voted to shutter five schools to close the district's $5 million budget deficit. An investigation by 12 News found that the voucher program played a significant role in this deficit, with parents using the vouchers to move their children into private schools. A 2023 report from Save Our Schools said that if only six students in a school leave to use an ESA voucher at a private school, the burden on the public school or district is equivalent to a full-time teacher's salary. Over $900 million drained from public education means every one of Arizona's public schools loses out on $300,000 in desperately needed dollars that will likely result in teacher layoffs and suddenly unaffordable fixed costs, such as repairing broken-down AC and buses, the report said. Less money for schools means less money for teacher bonuses, increased salaries, and even the additional materials students need to succeed. Notably, Arizona ranks 32nd in the nation for teacher pay, and a recent study said that more than half of Arizona teachers have considered leaving the profession. It's hard to teach kids if you don't have teachers. Teacher retention down, absenteeism up. When Hunahan encounters a ninth grader who isn't reading like one, her mind goes to teacher retention. While it's hard to blame teachers for moving to new districts, given the sorry state of teacher pay in Arizona, high rates of teacher turnover can hurt students. A study by researchers at Vanderbilt University and the University of Florida found that losing a teacher in the midst of the school year is linked with a loss of between 32 and 72 instructional days. Arizona has largely struggled with retaining high-quality teachers. A quarter of teacher vacancies across the state for the 2024-25 school year remain unfilled, while 52.2% of the vacancies are filled by teachers who do not meet the state's standard certification requirements, according to the Arizona School Personnel Administrators Association. Staffing up would certainly help, but it's not the only solution. Education advocates point to preschool access as a key factor when it comes to literacy rates, and studies show that students who attend high-quality preschool programs often do better in the long term. But for many Arizona families, preschool is simply not an option. Arizona currently ranks 43rd in the nation for preschool access. The 2023 State of Preschool Yearbook from the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers University notes that 4% of Arizona's four-year-olds attended a state-funded preschool program during the 2022-23 school year, compared with 35% nationwide. Literacy rates also are influenced by chronic absenteeism, which has worsened since the pandemic. According to a report from the Helios Education Foundation, chronic absenteeism especially affects a host of demographic groups: economically disadvantaged students, non-English-speaking students, American Indian or Alaska Native students, Black African American students, and Hispanic students. 35% of Arizona's economically disadvantaged students are chronically absent, compared with just 28% of their non-disadvantaged peers. Georgetown University-based think tank Future Ed has tracked chronic absenteeism rates since the 2018-19 school year. It found that Arizona had the 15th highest chronic absenteeism rate in the country for the 2022-23 school year, the last for which full data is available. Clark, Arizona's literacy director, said curtailing low attendance is a critical component of advancing students' literacy rates. Much of the rest has been shouldered not by schools, but instead by nonprofits. Organizations doing the work. To address the literacy gaps that the state education system apparently cannot fix, third-party organizations are stepping in. Read On Arizona has formed several partnerships to improve school readiness and third-grade reading outcomes. The California-based nonprofit Raising a Reader promotes equity-based learning, encouraging students to work with their kids at home to develop a love for reading. The organization's classic Red Book Bag program sends Arizona students home with 5 books each week and encourages parents to read with their children. Parents are instructed to use evidence-based strategies while reading, such as asking the children questions about the story or about the accompanying photos. That way, students stay engaged while reading in the reassuring presence of a trusted caregiver. Raising a Reader serves about 2,300 children across Arizona, focusing on students in kindergarten through third grade. Suzanne Metcalf, the organization's director of marketing and communications, stresses the importance of investing in this type of education. Every dollar invested in early literacy yields lifelong benefits, she said. It's a lifelong benefit, not just for the child, but for the families. Stand for Children, Arizona's Growing Readers, is a 10-week program that teaches parents the basis of literacy and how they can help at home. Growing Readers assists about 600 families across the state each year, focusing primarily on Title I schools, which serve lower-income students who need additional support. Stand for Children Arizona also advocates for education policies, such as 2020's Proposition 208, which would have funded education through a tax on high earners, but was overturned by the courts. The organization also has pushed to make dual language learning available in classrooms. Since 2001, Arizona has been beholden to Proposition 203, which disavows multi-language classroom learning and requires that students are taught primarily in English. The stated purpose of this legislation was to acquire a good knowledge of English, thereby allowing them to fully participate in the American dream. But 20 years later, the proposition has yet to prove its efficacy. The ban on multi-language learning hurts Arizona's immigrant communities. Non-English speaking students have dramatically lower literacy rates, with 86% of these children falling far below the average rate. Research shows that dual immersion programs, which allow students to learn in their native tongue and in English, have higher success rates. But Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, Tom Horn, has repeatedly disavowed them, suing schools that don't comply with the English-only approach. Earlier this month, a Maricopa County Superior Court judge dismissed a case filed by Carmen Chenal, Horn's wife, against Creighton Elementary School District over its dual-language program. It is the second case lost by Horn as he continues the crusade targeting schools with a multi-language model. Two education advocates for whom Horn has been an especially malevolent force. It's one more example of how Arizona gets in the way of educating its children. The state has, unfortunately, been derelict in fulfilling their constitutional responsibility, Mamani said. It's in the Constitution of Arizona that they should have funded equitable schools, and that's not what's happening. The I-10 Broadway Curve project will finally end in 2025. This last story for this week's program was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on December 31st. For almost 4 years, Valley residents have weathered constant headaches and detours as a large section of Interstate 10 has undergone reconstruction. Known as the I-10 Broadway Curve Improvement Project, the roadwork has spanned 11 miles of the interstate between Loop 202 and Interstate 17 near Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport. It's the largest freeway reconstruction project in the history of the Arizona Department of Transportation. And it's been a pain in the ass. The work has been so disruptive that ADOT created the Curve app to help Valley drivers navigate restrictions. But in 2025, motorists will finally be rewarded for their patience. The project is scheduled to be completed in spring, treating drivers to more and wider lanes, new bridges and sound walls, all in preparation for an expected 25% increase in traffic by 2040. The proposed improvements were derived predominantly from research conducted by MAG between April 2014 and May 2017. The Spine Study analyzed long-term strategies to improve mobility in the I-10 and I-17 corridor. The study suggested that the reconstruction would reduce travel times on I-10 by 2.5 million hours per year, improve access to Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport, support ride sharing and public transportation options, and prepare the area for the Valley's projected growth. That does bring us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrock.